So Sinai 36 was the first expedition. I tell you why I love this photo, because you've got my sister and brother-in-law over here who are absolutely beaming with excitement.
Yes.
Now it's so time for me to go, and then my poor parents. They're going, oh my God, what are you doing? This was taken on deck of the ship as we're about to go. I was at law school at the time. I was a few months away. I had articles at a great firm. My parents thought I was finally going to give up all my craziness because I'd done some silly things before. And then I went and said, oh, by the way, I'm not going to be a lawyer next year. I'm going to Antarctica. But they were wonderful. They grew to embrace it. So it was the first team in the new base. There'd been a hiatus of a few years. As you well know. So there was this big discontinuity in the program. We didn't have the benefit of getting a handover from another team. We went into a base that just was untested and untried. Our changeover, our first summer, was incredibly stressful. We worked 16 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Just to
build the base. No, we were working with Public Works Department to build that base. And it was incredibly stressful. We hadn't actually even met each other properly.
So you didn't have any proper team training
before? We had some. We did have some of the training. But the first time that everyone met everyone was about a week before we were left alone, because we had our doctor came late. She hadn't even met us.
Amy Rouse.
The first woman to ever winter at Sinai. Incredibly brave woman to have done that. She hadn't met anyone. She just arrived. Already we were all on the ice.
By plane or by Gallus?
All by the ships. The Gallus in that season did three trips because of the construction.
And she also had to deal probably with the construction crews themselves as well.
Yes. So it was very heavy on Public Works.
For your polo circle event?
This wasn't the crossing of the circle. This was just entertainment on board ship. We went down very early that year. We left the 1st of November with the intention of trying to get a head start on the construction. Took us about a month to get down because we took a gamble and it just didn't pay off. The ice was very thick. So to entertain ourselves, we'd play games on boards. That was a tug of war on the helicopter deck, strung through some pulleys.
When you went down, was there a shell already?
Yes. So there'd been work for two or three seasons before. What was in place was the shell of blocks A and B and the skeleton of block C.
Ooh.
And so all the interior of blocks A and B had to be done, and the exterior and interior of block C. It was a huge task. Like I said, was working 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. The physical effort, the strain on everyone there was immense.
So the team members actually had to help physically with the construction.
Yes, we did, and we were all doing different things, so there was no cohesion as a team. Because we were all working off in different areas, and it was kind of hard to form a team in that environment, just because even existing teams, public work teams, were just under so much strain and so much pressure. The best thing was when you'd wake up in the morning and you'd feel a storm.
Yes.
So we lived in this construction base, which was just converted cargo containers a few hundred meters down the hill from the base. And you'd feel it vibrating, and you'd think, oh, thank heavens, and you could sleep. And, so the storms would last a few days. After the first day, maybe well into the second day, people would start emerging and start getting bored and listless. And eventually, people would want the storm to finish.
But so even in winter, there was construction people?
No.
No,
construction happens in the summers, in the preceding summers. The first summer, they just went and they drilled the piles, the supports. The second summer, they went and they put up the skeleton, the steel skeleton work. Then I think it was over three summers. The third, they'd started putting the base together. I parked that one.
Can you remember the name of the vehicle?
Number two.
Oh, just number two. Didn't you give them names?
No.
No.
No, no, there wasn't that same sort of romance. I think in the earlier teams, they had fewer vehicles and they were much more attached to them. Yeah, you know, we had a large fleet. There really wasn't that kind of sentimentality about the vehicles. So I guess what I want to try and do is pull out what would have been unique about our experience. It was tough. It was stressful. Mm. It was great. Mm. It was absolutely marvelous, and I'm very happy with it. But before I went, I made a point of speaking to some previous leaders.
Mm.
And I remember one of them said to me, he was sitting in my office in Pretoria, and he said to me, it was the most stressful experience I've ever had. And I was sitting there going, yeah, yeah, whatever. I didn't understand it until I was down there.
What made it stressful, apart from the long work hours?
Well, the whole experience. So we were down there 16 months.
Mm-hmm.
So it started off with an environment that was interesting. In our second summer, the Air Force changed over the helicopters from the Super Pumas to the Oryxes. And they're operating 4 helicopters down there that season, which I think is the only season.
That's a pretty big show also with the 4 of them.
Yes,
they
did a little air show for us. So the stress, it's a naturally stressful environment. Mm. You've got a very heterogeneous group of people who are thrust together in a strange environment. You have to be completely self-sufficient. It takes a strange mix of gregarious and also a bit of a loner. You know, you have to be able to just leave behind your family and friends, but then you have to be able to bond completely with a bunch of strangers.
We would not necessarily bond with.
Exactly. You wouldn't necessarily choose as your friends, and these people are your colleagues, your friends, your family, everything.
Your flatmates.
Yes. And that's in a very alien environment. Mm. You recognize that's what's left of Sanai 3. It's a very alien environment. You have to survive. You have different decisions to make compared to normal. You know, when you're living here in Joburg, very few of your decisions are, well, if I do this, I live. If I don't do it, I die. Suddenly there, you're faced with these life and death decisions all the time. And so we had this...
In the older photographs you saw, they also have these ones, but they only have Main Road. And there's like Bouvet and Oslo.
And Springs.
Well, this was the sign that we dug up. This was left from Sanai 3.
Ah. Where is it now?
Hopefully somewhere down there.
There, okay.
Not sure exactly where. There's two reasons why the signs all point in the same direction. One is you're so far south that most things are pretty much north. Secondly, anything that pointed off in other directions got blown off.
Okay. So what direction did those point then?
That's mainly northish. Mm. You know, for instance, any signs that would have pointed off to North America or South America, which would have been perpendicular to that, would have got blown off.
No. Okay.
But so the reasons for the stress, and particularly in our year, the base was new. It was untested. We had occasions where the base came very close to failure. The heating, the power generation systems, their cooling and the heating of the base are all linked.
Mm.
And if that's the state of the base when we arrived. So if the base cools down too much, then you get freezing of the cooling coils that are supposed to cool the engines.
Mm.
And what happens is you suddenly lose your ability to power the base. So we were on a few occasions in bad storms confronted with the possibility just a few seconds away of losing all our power generation ability, and we would have had to have moved down into the construction base for the rest of the period and live very primitive and nasty lives.
How long did you stay in a construction base? Did you ever stay in a construction base?
Yes, when we moved in, for the first 2 months, everyone was living in the construction base because the main base just wasn't ready. It was just impossible for us to stay in it. And then it was quite a momentous occasion when we were when the team, the overwintering team, was able to move out and move up into the base, incomplete as it then was. I mean, the toilets weren't working. You've heard about the Swartzaki system?
Yes.
You've heard about all the jokes around it?
No.
So we...
Well, I haven't actually heard about the Swartzaki system. I just know they want a new system in Marion based on that.
Oh, okay. So the Swartzaki system, when away from the base, and where we had a rather ineffective water treatment system, when you go to the toilets, there's no delicate way of describing this. When you want to pee, there's a big 200 liter oil drum that the men would pee into with a little funnel. When you have to go do something else, there's this wooden construction toilet. You lift up the toilet seat and there's a hole with nails, and you take your Swartzaki and you put the sake around on the holes, put the toilet seat back down. When you're finished, you take your Swartzaki, you tie a knot in it, and then you go and dump it in a drum, and that's all returned back to South Africa. It's that system still used now. When you're away from the base on a field trip or something, that's exactly how you go to the toilet, and all human waste gets removed and taken home. It's a very strange situation. You walk out of the toilets and you've got your Swartzaki, and you see your friend, hey, how's it going? You carry your Swartzaki. And it's also, you know, like an interesting feedback mechanism. You go, okay, how much did I eat yesterday? And then when new people come to the base and they explain the Swartzaki system, there was a standing joke where you say, and in order to preserve space in the drums where we throw the Swartzakis, you have to remove all the air from the Swartzaki, so you have to suck the air up. And you see people now, faces looking shocked and horrid at the possibility of removing the air.
What did the female doctor do? Was she the only female present during this time?
No, we also had... Now, in that first summer, was she the only female? I'm trying to recall. I can look at my diary. There was another... there was an environmental officer. First summer, yes, we had Joanne Daniel, who was one of the environmental officers. Second summer, there was someone from Omgeving Sake who came down to do inventory. And also, of course, there was Nell, what was her first name? There was a woman in... there were two women, Nell and the physicist from the TEL. You were in the SANI 37 team.
Okay.
But for a while, I think for a while, Annie may have been the only woman, or one of the only two women on the base.
It wasn't noticeable there's only one woman then?
I think for her it was noticeable. It certainly had a strong moderating effect on the crowd. If you have a lot of men all alone, then... they behave very differently to if there's just one woman. And Annie was quite a conservative influence and certainly just moderated all of our behaviour.
I was just thinking about the description of the toilet and you said, what would she do? Obviously, the Swartzaki she can also use.
Yes, well, she just wouldn't use the strums.
Okay.
Yes. She managed quite well, but for instance, in the construction base, there was just one set of showers, so there was a special time designated for her. Because there was no woman's shower, so she would have her own shower time when the men obviously couldn't go into the communal showers.
You also stayed in tents?
No, this was going out and provisioning the geologists' field team. So, you know, they arrive, they head out on their skidoos, spend a couple of months in the field, come back, have a shower, and then get on the ship. Okay. So, and during the time out in the fields, the helicopters go out and provision them with supplies.
Was that still the Sarimare base?
No, this was a completely mobile base.
No, but where the geologists stayed?
Yes, so they'll go anywhere. They'll just go find a place where there's interesting rocks and put up their tents and walk around and chip off rocks.
Okay.
So it didn't have any particular name. This was going down one of the buttresses. I'm assuming that you've got a lot of knowledge, you understand the layout of the base and how it all fits in.
Yes.
So this is going down one of those buttresses to sample the water quality, because the water treatment plant wasn't working that well, and so we had rather smelly brown water going down the side of the rock face, which was in contravention of our treaty obligations.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly what the status of that is now, but we're going to fix that.
I think they have a sort of a bacteria-based
Yes. Well, that's what it was supposed to be then, but just the bacteria weren't that happy and weren't eating all the waste like they should have. You saw us there climbing down. There was that death last year when they were going down the crevasse. I know it was published as a training exercise. You know, I smiled sadly to myself because you do it for entertainment. People go out and they play. They play on, you know, climbing on the cliffs and climbing in the crevasses. It's really not a training exercise. But it would have to have been framed like that.
Obviously. I got the idea people climb down crevasses for exercise, but also just because it's nice and it's something you can't do here. About the construction, were you there when, I think the guy's called Eric Mini, when he was lost in the blizzard, one of the construction guys, and found him after 14 hours or something?
No, and it wasn't Eric Mini, that was, his name I think was, why do I think Pierre Fenter there, that's where he was found. So it was in the season prior, so we got there at the end of 96, so it was the 95-96 changeover. It was one of the Air Force support guys. He went out from the construction base during the storm. The construction base's layout was very different then. It was just a bunch of separate cabins, and moving from one to another, he lost his way and was found the next morning when the storm cleared, and that was the point where he was found.
I'm thinking, I'm talking about a different incident with one of the construction guys. He went out. I can't remember if they searched why he went out, but he was lost for about 8 hours or 4 hours, and they found him alive.
Eric Mini, that rings a bell. It could have been him. So that was in the 97-98 changeover. It was the first year that South Africa flew.
That's a funny photo. Are you having a braai there?
Yes. It was minus 20.
Yeah, that's why I'm laughing. What is up with the t-shirt and the snow?
Well, it was the first time we could go outside. So that was me. I don't know if you recognize me. That's me on the right. Brian.
With the t-shirt.
Yes. And, you know, you want to get outside and enjoy it. And I guess there's a bit of bravado as well. And, you know, when my knees started turning purple, I went inside and changed. Right. This was us trying to braai indoors during a storm. There's the
black label.
The black label and the oxygen masks because of all the smoke indoors. Eric Mini. Yes. So it was the first year that South Africa flew people down. It was 97-98 changeover. They flew an advanced crew of public works guys down to an ice base called Blue One, which was a few hundred miles away from Sanai. They arrived and the weather closed in and they weren't able to fly on the smaller twin otters from Blue One to Sanai. They'd fly a Hercules from Cape Town to Blue One and then twin otters from Blue One to Sanai. So the guys had to stay in tents during the storm. And it's coming back to me now, I'm pretty sure it was Eric Mini who, during that storm, left the tent, got lost. They found him. He had he wasn't badly frostbitten, but you know, he was in the early stages of it, and they managed to save him, and you know, he was fine and came and was able to work the rest of the season, which was a near miss because you saw that cross of the guy who 2 years before that. I could be wrong. The name Pierre Fenter comes to mind.
It comes to mind as well.
Who, in very similar circumstances, in a storm, left the cabin. That's midnight. It's New Year's Eve, 96-97. You can see that it's from the construction base. Looking up on the right, just behind the flag, is the base. Gives you some perspective of where the construction base was.
I'm just noticing again the colours there in the distance. Did you realise there's going to be some controversy about the colours of the
that we were building the biggest old South African flag ever constructed. Yes, no, very aware of it. I mean, remember, 1996, that Senator Stephen Grevier, who came down during the middle of the summer season for the official opening of the base, it was him.
In a wheelchair?
Yes.
Wow.
I don't know what happened to him now. He was an ANC senator. I'm not sure why particularly he had the honour of unveiling the base. So we had a whole bunch of dignitaries and journalists, etc., who came down. There was a big party. The base was absolutely not completed. They then got back on the Gallus, sailed home, and we continued with the construction of the base. And the base, so when it was left, and I'll get back to the question of the flags, there's some interesting politics. When the base was left and we had to move into it, it was such a rush. Literally the last of the PW Public Works Department guys, they dropped their tools where they'd been working and ran for the last helicopter that took them off to the Bukta to the ship.
So they really literally worked to the last minute?
To the last minute. Things were incomplete. We had a lot of work to do. We felt a little bit resentful even because there was still so much for us to do. Winter was coming. We knew that we had to get the base in shape for the winter, and it wasn't ready yet.
And I suppose there were also scientists on the team, so they couldn't actually do their work.
Yeah, so they had to start with their research. I mean, that's exactly why we were there. But everyone just had to just get stuck in and get involved and do stuff. Mm. Which wasn't the sole cause of our stress. It was certainly something that added to it. The flag, so yeah, it's quite ironic there. The base was poorly sealed. You can see Antarctica coming into the base there during the storms. So this was in 1996. So, you know, just 2 years after the new constitution, democracy, whatever. And the civil service was still in a state of change. And, you know, there were many people who were very proud to have the old South African flag there. Are you learning to recognize me yet in these photos?
Slightly.
So I'm the one there on our left. That's cleaning the heat exchangers.
And also, you look quite the caveman.
Well, there's all this soot, all this carbon in the heat exchangers. So there were...
what's that about?
Spring day.
Spring day.
Just way too cold still to go outside, but we just thought that we'd celebrate it anyway.
Why are you dressed like an Arab?
You know, just you bring down stuff that you can dress up in and you take whatever you can find.
Okay, back to the flag, sorry.
I'll tell you, interesting commentary here. This was our team photo at the end of the year. There were 10 of us in the team. If you count there's only 9 there. So one of the guys at this stage, he decided he didn't even want to be in the team photo. He had removed himself from the team. He just didn't want
to
be
part of it. Went his own way.
Yeah. Now, here's the irony of how Omgewingswake would think about managing the SANA. We all did questionnaires where we all assessed everyone else, and the guy who had removed himself from the team, resoundingly, everyone to the question, would you recommend him for future expeditions? Everyone said no, absolutely not. 2 years later, Omgewingswake brought him back down to run a takeover. Because he had technical skills, but there was just no acknowledgement of social skills. You know, there were certain people who really shouldn't have ever been selected to go down there. I question sometimes whether I would have chosen myself as the expedition leader, just I was so young and inexperienced. But they just didn't look at things like that and would just thrust people in who weren't necessarily ready or prepared, in part because they didn't have a big pool to choose from and not have to take what they could get. So the politics, the flag, there was still... Annie Rouse, the doctor, there she was converting a sleeping bag into a kite. We got her to run the sewing machine, not because she was a woman, but because she was the surgeon. And we figured that she would know how
needles
to do this.
Yes. Yeah.
So there was still even attempted racial segregation when I was down there.
Really?
Had they got married, Heindebier and Annie Rouse.
It's racial segregation?
Yes. So in the second summer, everyone now was living in the main base. And there were attempts by both Omgewingswake and Public Works to segregate racially the team. They wanted to... There were a few black members of the Public Works Department. And they wanted to put them in a separate block from all the white public works department guys, like in a separate room. All the white public works guys were in block B. There was one room available at the end of block A. They wanted to put the black workers there.
And the coloured guys?
The coloured guys were accepted with the whites. The blacks were a completely different class. So the roles and responsibilities were a little unclear. You know, so there was the head of the public works guy, who's actually still there. Not public works, Omgevingsake guy, who was officially in charge during the takeover. And then the head of the public works, he was supposed to be in charge of the public works people. But I said, listen, I'm the leader, I'm responsible for the base, and we're not having segregation. I said, they said, well, we overrule, we outrank you. So I said, fine, put it in writing. And they backed down. Because, so as soon as I said, I'll accept your authority, but give me a written instruction, they then changed it, and then the public works team was racially integrated in their accommodation. But it created a lingering sense of hostility that after the guys weren't very happy with me because of that. And this is nothing new. This was in my reports. Have you got the leaders' reports? Do you have access to them?
We don't. Where are they?
Probably also at Omgevingsake.
Yes, it would be. At the end of every season, the leaders were supposed to write a report. They should be there. I'm sure you should have decades worth of leaders' reports if you go and ask for them.
We have contacted Henry Valentine about it, but he's very busy currently with the Marion.
Is there some Forstler still doing HR for?
Yes, she's still.
Ask Susan.
I'll ask her.
She's marvelously efficient, Susan.
That's really interesting because I suppose you, as far as I could assess from just reading the names, as one do, there weren't any black or coloured team members.
No. Ours was the first team with a woman, the last all-white team. Actually, no, there were the team after us, I think they had one black member, but the team after that was all-white again.
Mm.
So there was a couple of years where it was swinging from racially integrated to not. But yeah, we were.
Well, there could be several reasons for that.
Yes. In part, just there's the polluted effluent discharge.
Gosh.
In part, just because it's hard to find people anyway. Now you have to try and find technically qualified black members of the team. It's tricky.
It's tricky, yeah.
That's the Norwegian inspector team, you know, under the Antarctic Treaty System. Everyone just gets to inspect everyone else.
How many visits did you have from other teams? Or not teams from other countries? Of this new base.
Yeah, the Germans came. So at Neumayr, they're the closest base. And as you know now, for offloading the ship, they actually use Neumayr and then they bring it over land. At that stage, there was no established over-surface route. And they only would fly in. So the Germans came in. Swedes and Norwegians from Troll would come in. We also had somewhere there would have been a photo in there that I missed along the way. We had the first tourist circumnavigation come to us at the coast at E-Base. It was on the, I can check my diary if you need, it was on the Captain Klebnikov, I think, for outrageous sums of money, many tens of thousands of dollars. The tourists sailed around the whole continent, stopping at different bases. They stopped at us. We gave them the whole tour of E-Base, explained the Swartzaki system to them.
Did you give them a meal?
Yes. I don't know. Somewhere there, did you see the pictures of us? There were some guys with some platters of food. And
No, but there was a picture of you sitting around a table with flags in the background.
No, that would have been midwinter.
Yes.
So what you've seen here is my standard out-of-the-box slideshow that I give if people want to see it. So the commentary, I talk about the... Anyway, you saw the footprints, reverse footprints, and then I talk about just getting back and being able to walk barefoot on the grass, which is amazing.
Would you give these slideshows to just your friends?
Yes, every now and again people roll me out and say, do a... Antarctic slideshow, and so just these are the slides I chose of the thousands.
Slab and machine.
Yes, yes. It's just such a schlep to scan every single one of the photos. So we were one of the last analog teams. Mm-hmm. I took down the first digital camera at Sinai.
Really?
It was a primitive little thing.
Probably one pixel. One pixel camera.
Yeah, probably 1 by 1 pixel. You could see the color. You know, we had the dark room, and we'd buy thousands of rands worth of chemicals, and we'd process this all ourselves. The dark room now is probably just the storeroom.
I think so.
It's, yeah.
But when all these construction people left, and I suppose you didn't get that much visits in the winter, how was it then? You know, all this activity, and then suddenly nothing.
How was it, the change? It is a big change, but I think for us it was a relief because that first summer of construction was so intense and such hard work. It was a relief to just reduce the intensity a little bit.
Mm.
We weren't able to relax yet because we had so much to do to prepare the base for winter. But I think amongst all of us there was just a sense of, okay, great, now we can be together as a team for the first time. So relieved. When the changeover crew arrived at the end of the winter, there was a sense of them as sort of outsiders coming in and intruding on our place. It wasn't that bad, you know, we were happy to see them. Different, I guess, from most normal teams, because we had worked so closely with them and so hard with them that we had established good relationships with these people, because again there were a lot of public works guys who came down, so they were our friends and associates who returned rather than a bunch of strangers. Whereas in a normal changeover, I'd imagine, having never been through one, the overwintering team arrives, they just form a unit with the previous overwintering team, have a whole lot less to do with the summer crew, and probably don't have that same sort of set of relationships that we had. That said, the takeover crew are briefed very carefully to respect the space of the overwintering team. They say, listen, these guys aren't very well adjusted to society. You have to just treat them. And you can see that I was quite amused by it because they try so hard.
Okay.
And I was thinking, guys, you don't have to be that sensitive. We know you guys. Don't worry about it. But they're very sensitive and they don't want to step on any toes. We all got sick. You know, we hadn't been exposed to any outside germs for a year, and suddenly the year's worth of flu and cold germs arrived. So everyone had a few weeks, all the members of my team had a few weeks of coughs and colds and sneezes, which is apparently just totally normal.
By that time, when the first construction, when they left for the winter, was that team member you spoke about already acting a bit on his own? Isolating.
At the beginning of the first, at the end of the first takeover?
At the end of the first takeover.
He was a difficult fellow from the start. You know, in his interview, in his selection interview, when they asked him, why do you want to go to Antarctica? His answer was to be alone. Bad answer.
Bad answer.
But he was a competent engineer. And so he was chosen purely for his technical ability. And like I said, and invited back again to run a takeover where he was doing the takeover for Sinai 37-38. Have you met Duncan Cromarty? Wonderful fellow. He was the expedition leader for Sinai 38. And he and this guy that I'm talking about had a massive argument as well. During that takeover, which just showed that, you know, there were good reasons why the team had said don't bring him back.
Were you specifically chosen as team leader? Was that the position you applied for?
No. So in those days, leader was a position all of its own. One of my recommendations in my expedition report was that it should be combined with another position. I doubt it was exclusively because of my recommendation. I don't think seriously, but there's probably an overwhelming weight of opinion saying it should be leader plus something. Draw the leader out of one of the other positions. So I'm not sure when that changed. I think Sinai, I know Sinai 37, Sinai 38, there was dedicated leader.
I think it was about Sinai 40 only.
Okay, then they started having others. So for, in my case, I hadn't ever really applied for the expedition. I was at law school. Mm-hmm. I was an engineer. I still had an email account on the engineering server. There was an email that went out to everyone saying they're looking for an electrical engineer. I hadn't practiced as an engineer for years. Mm-hmm. And I just contacted Susan Vosloo to say, geez, tell me what South Africa's doing down there. I was just intrigued. I wanted to know more. I had articles at a law firm. I was going to be a lawyer in a few months. And so she said, well, tell me about yourself. And next thing, they had my CV and I was there for interviews. They were taking me very seriously. And I like to joke that I was being interviewed as the engineer, but because I was such a pathetic engineer, they made me the engineer.
Did you have to write exams down there then if you were still busy with your articles?
I was still busy with my LLB, with the actual studies, hadn't even got to articles. So I arranged with UNISA to study down there and took quite a few phone calls. Most people said, no, it's impossible, until I found one person at UNISA who said, yeah, let's see what we can do.
Mm.
And in the team after me, They also brought some UNISA courses down. I'm not sure whether people are still doing UNISA courses down there, but we established the southernmost UNISA exam center. So I wrote my exams down there. One of my fellow team members, Piet Swanefelder, was my invigilator. And he watched me to make sure I wasn't cheating. And I did my exam. And then it was, I can't remember if it was faxed up to Pretoria or sent with a ship or whatever.
Oh, okay. Where did you find time to study, though?
Oh, there's a lot of time. There's a lot of time in the winter. You have a couple of hours work a day, if that. And geez, I mean, I watched more movies there. I read more books. I drank more than I'd ever done before or since. So, life in the base in the winter, you've got whatever your duties are. So, I had some of my own experiments that I was running. There's a bit of admin work. Once every 10 days you have skivvy duty. You know about skivvy duty?
Yes. How did you work with cooking then? Did you have team evening meals, team suppers?
Yes. So one compulsory meal for everyone to attend, which was the dinner every day. The rest of the time people could do their own things.
Okay.
So, breakfast people would amble in at whatever time and make themselves whatever breakfast. And normally it's a couple of people sitting around together having breakfast or lunch.
How did sleeping patterns work? I mean, I've heard that in wintertime or even in summer, your sleeping patterns sometimes totally confused. The biorhythm.
Yes. So in summer, you have 24 hours light, but it's easy enough to get darkness. You go into the room and you close the blinds. So it's less disruptive. And also your patterns are largely dictated by the routine on the base, because there was work hours, there's daily breakfast, and very little disruption in the summer. Just in the first summer particularly, we were sleep deprived because of we were working so hard. Then once we were left alone, the days are getting shorter and shorter, and it was amazing. There was one night that suddenly all of us, our clocks just lost it and found all 10 of us sitting down in the dining room together going, you can't sleep. And it was amazing how it was synchronized that we reached a certain point where there just wasn't enough sunlight in the day to keep your clocks properly set, and thereafter everyone's routines kind of drift a little bit from each other. Some people wake up a whole lot later, some people have more sleep, some people have less sleep, but it is very disruptive not having the sun every day to reset your clock.
Back then, how was the communication with South Africa? Did you have email accounts?
Yeah, we
telephone calls.
So phone, we had the Pretoria phone number through the satellite. We had very low bandwidth internet, so we couldn't surf the web, but I know it was hard. But remember, this is 1997, hey? So there's not a lot of web to surf.
No YouTube.
No. So we had email, which we'd be able to keep in touch. We had the Mail and Guardian emailed us their newspaper every week. That was the only regular newspaper that we had, because the Mail and Guardian, really the first online newspaper, the others didn't have any online presence. Mm-hmm. So they had the email product, and they were happy to donate it to us down there.
And but how was it receiving news from back in South Africa? I think it was still quite unstable back then. Or?
No, we had local phone calls. So we were able to stay in touch. During the summer, when there were a lot more people on the base. Mm. The access to the phone was obviously more limited because everyone wants to have their calls, so it was scheduled. But in the winter, it was really unlimited access. Mm. While we were there, Princess Diana died. And that incident probably gave me the best sense of how removed we were from normal society. Mm-hmm. Because it was like being on another planet and watching these Earth things go crazy about stuff that just meant so little to us down there.
Yeah.
Every single time we spoke to anyone back home, all they wanted to tell us was about Princess Diana. We realized the world had lost its head about her. And
afterwards, probably when you saw all the flowers and the documentaries. And
yeah, we saw that, and we were just so far removed from it. You know, some people, I guess, in the team were more interested than others, but there was really a sense of being removed and watching this frenzy from afar. I don't know how old you guys were.
Old enough to remember, clearly.
You remember that
absolute
frenzy.
You know, you remember where you were when you received the news, kind of thing. It's like 9/11, you remember what you were doing.
Yes, very much like that. And so we just watched this frenzy and realized how removed we were from normal society, that there's this global collective consciousness event happening, and we were just going, please don't tell us more about this. I'm really not interested.
As team leader of the first team that stayed in this new base, which they promoted as quite, you know, it's the groundbreaking base, etc., did you ever receive a special directive from the Department of Environment?
I don't think so. What's a special directive?
Something like, you know, this is the, where they told you, this is the new base, this and this should be done, or you are representative of South Africa, so do this or do that.
Not with quite that level of formality. Yeah. I think it was just implicit in the day-to-day work. I spent a few months working in Pretoria at Environmental Affairs head office before I went down there. And you know, that was part of the daily discussion, but there was never any formality like you being invested with this great responsibility.
Okay.
I remember I had to get security clearance as leader, and I had this questionnaire form that I had to fill in, and I was happy to give information about myself, but then it wanted personal information about friends and family, and I said, it's bullshit. Why should I invade the privacy of my friends? I said, I'm not doing this. And they said, well, then you're not getting your security clearance. I said, okay. and then they step back and went, okay. I guess that's all right then. You know, I think there was, you know, we were really in a state of transition from very old Bruderbond style, where this was Die Trots von South Africa, and that probably thinking about this as some military significance or something, to realizing this is it's a civilian project. Mm-hmm. You don't need security clearance, for heaven's sake.
Mm.
Well, that's what I'm assuming. Maybe if I had got my security clearance, I would have found out some stuff. But I assume not. You know, there was this change in consciousness. You know, times were changing. Remember, during the apartheid years, the Antarctic Treaty System and SANA were very important for South Africa because we weren't excluded. There were sanctions that were excluding us from almost everything else.
Yeah,
but the Antarctic Treaty System, through the Cold War, Russia and America sat on it and cooperated the whole way. South Africa remained on it. So,
and they tried to keep it this apolitical.
Yes, and it was done very successfully, and that's part of the success of the Antarctic Treaty System. I think from South Africa's perspective, it was maybe a little bit of a backdoor into diplomatic circles that we were otherwise excluded from. And so perhaps for those reasons, there was a sense of its strategic importance.
Mm.
And now this was changing because we had been invited back into the global community, and it was just one other place where we were interacting with the rest of the world.
Did you have things like, speaking military, made me think about this, did you have things like, were there guns on base, straitjackets or things like that?
No, I wish there were straitjackets. I'd like to have locked a few people in this. No weapons under the Antarctic Treaty, not allowed any, and we certainly didn't have any, none that I was aware of. And no straitjackets. Geez, I don't know, amongst the medical supplies, if maybe there was one somewhere, if we dug deep enough, we could have found something. But no, nothing sinister and like that.
Speaking about medical supplies, how was it to see this relationship develop between the medic and...
It was very entertaining.
Very entertaining.
Because they tried to hide it, obviously.
Well,
why not?
I think the rest of us were aware of it before they were. Both of them quite conservative. And, you know, we could see... I don't want it to sound in any way patronizing, but we could see sort of quite a naive kind of romance developing between them, and you know, before I think they were ready to acknowledge it for themselves or to anyone else, and then they reached a certain critical point where they're fine, they were happy with it, and after that, and they'd walk along hand in hand. It was unbelievable. They'd walk around the whole time holding hands, like walking the narrow passageways, and they'd go up the stairs holding hands, and you know, the rest of us would joke about, oh my god, they're holding hands again. You know, their relationship progressed, and you know, that start sharing a room, but then they were trying to do it very discreetly, and then less and less discreetly. So during the changeover, everyone was sharing rooms. So Amy was sharing it with, what is the name of the Durban physicist, Belinda, maybe? Yeah. So Amy was sharing with another woman. Hein was sharing with another guy. So then they would use the hospital as their rendezvous point. You know, we'd find that sometimes the hospital door would be locked and we couldn't find them. They were inside the hospital.
But it sounded like it didn't really cause any jealousy or disruption in the team as a whole.
No, heavens no. Like there hadn't been any competition for Amy's affections, which I guess would have been how... It could have been divisive, but you know, there wasn't anyone else competing for that, and so it worked fine. If it did add to the social dynamic, it would have been that in the social interactions and the dynamics within the team, now they were a unit, and if there were any issues, we knew that they would behave as one. And so, you know, one had to be wary of that. An insult or injury to one would be an insult or injury to the other. We were sponsored with a whole bunch of chutas from State Kinnikor, who gave us movies, and we got wine, and a whole bunch of different things. And at the end of our winter, we decided to donate some of the stuff to the base and to share out the rest of the loot. And... we had a whole sort of bidding system where, because there were certain things that everyone wanted, so we worked out a process, and they sort of coordinated their bidding together. Quite strategic about, and so, you know, so they really were pooling their stuff, and I think had a clear idea in their minds then that they were going to be together afterwards. The fact that they were really pooling their property
together. If there were any conflict in the team, what mostly caused conflict?
There was conflict, without a doubt. There was conflict. Probably the root cause was just a bunch of different people being forced together in a stressful environment. What the particular symptoms were in every case differed. I'm trying to think if there were any recurring themes. You know, as leader, I would find myself often in the midst of the conflicts. There was that one guy who had a problems with dealing with any form of authority. There was another one who just was very immature. There were two people in our team who everyone or the majority recommended shouldn't have been there, shouldn't be invited onto, and they were often in the middle of the conflict. I was 25. I'd had no formal work experience. I'd had no formal management experience. And I'm very comfortable now admitting that I just didn't have the repertoire of management skills to deal with the situation. You know, it's a very challenging management environment, far more than in a normal environment here where at the end of the day you get to go home and leave everyone. You know, I've learned many lessons as a leader and a manager since that I understand mistakes that I made that I could have done a better job of just diffusing conflict, avoiding conflicts. Like I said earlier with the whole selection process of Omgevingsake, I would never have put a 25-year-old without management experience into that position. Just wouldn't have done it. Doesn't matter how smart and capable he looks, you don't put someone in that position. No, that's it. We did okay as a team. I did okay as a leader. I don't think we were the best team ever. We certainly weren't the worst team ever. There's some teams one gets a sense of having an incredible affinity and tears. I think Sanai 37 seemed to have that. They remained very cohesive, and I think a lot of it was they didn't have the rough start that we had. They were a team from the start. They came in, we looked after them as a team and helped them. But also the personalities involved, and Paul van Staden, I don't know if you've been in touch with him, he lives in Chicago now. Very charismatic guy. He had a lot of experience as a manager as well, and he did a fantastic job of molding them as a team. And even now when he visits the country, they'll have a reunion, they'll all get together.
Just quickly, because we don't have a lot of time, on that point, career-wise, would you say it was a good decision?
For me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. What did you learn? What did you take back from that experience on Antarctica?
I learned a lot about leadership and management. If I were to distill it into one single most important lesson, I'd say leading is as much about knowing when to do nothing as it is about knowing what to do when you have to do something. Mm. So there were two benefits for me. One was the experience, the learning. I'm just talking about professionally now. Understanding you have to deal with different people differently. It's not one size fits all. The second benefit is just the branding. It's quite impressive to stick on your CV, expedition leader. And I hadn't anticipated how long that would stick with me. Even now, you know, it's something that people notice and pick up on. We're colleagues and associates when we're meeting partners or whoever. Very often they'll say, and he led the expedition to Antarctica. We lived there for a year and a half. You know, it's a conversation point, but also it just seems to carry some pedigree and branding
personally?
With it. Personally as well, friends who I've known for years will still bring it up and ask me about it amongst newer friends. You know, it will get brought up and I have to sit and talk about it. People are understandably fascinated by it, and as much as it can get boring talking about it, I think there's a responsibility. It's such an honor and privilege to have been able to go down there and had such a long and intense experience of it, that there's a responsibility to share it. You know, people ask me, they say, so who pays for this? And my answer is, you did, thank you.
The taxpayer.
Yes. And as such, I think there's a responsibility to share it. And I'm glad of the work that you're doing, because it's part of sharing that heritage. There's been a massive investment of money and human capital, and that does need to be shared. And I think it's a source of pride for South Africa. It's a source of potentially great experience and knowledge that needs to be shared. Really, people should be applying in their thousands and being turned away.
How would you describe Antarctica?
Tough question, because, you know, like in terms of what? So in terms of the...
Whatever terms comes up in your mind first.
Alien. It's an alien place. You it's just unlike anything you've experienced before. It's beautiful. It's subtle. I learned that I like stark environments. Stark, in other words. When you're in a place like this, there's so much sensory input all around you that you can get lazy. When you're there, you're forced to focus on the minute detail, subtle changes of color and shade over the surface of the ice, the ripples in the ice, the cycles of the sun and the moon. You start becoming so attuned to such subtleties, which you lose in more lush and tropical environments because they're just so much. It's fragile. You know, as vast and even hostile as it is, you get a sense of its fragility. You anywhere you go, you can immediately see the signs of human impact. You drive a vehicle deep into the interior to set up a depot for the geologists, and if the vehicle's been idling for a while, you see soot on this otherwise virgin snow, and you realize, I put that there. Suddenly it spews out some antifreeze. You have this bright green square. Anything you do, you see an immediate impact, and you realize how fragile it is. It's fun. It's a great playground. It's for anyone with any sense of adventure, it's an incredible place just to go and play.
Okay.
How's that? Is that enough adjectives?
That's enough adjectives, yes. That's a beautiful description. Okay, thank you very much.